The Gospel according to St. Mark, the 13th chapter. But in those days after that suffering, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers in the heavens will be shaken. Then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory. Then he will send out the angels and gather his elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of the heaven. From the fig tree, learn its lesson. As soon as its branch becomes tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. So also, when you see these things taking place, you know that he is near at the very gates. Truly, I tell you, this generation will not pass away until all these things have taken place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. But about that day or hour, no one knows. Neither the angels in heaven nor the Son, but only the Father. Beware, keep alert, for you do not know when the time will come. It is like a man going on a journey when he leaves home and puts his slaves in charge, each with his work, and commands the doorkeeper to be on the watch. Therefore, keep awake. For you do not know when the master of the house will come, in the evening, or at midnight, or at cockcrow, or at dawn, or else he may find you asleep when he comes suddenly. And what I say to you, I say to all, keep awake. The Gospel of the Lord. My favorite author died this week. Her name is P.D. James, a British murder mystery writer and one of my favorite all-time authors. My prized possession is a copy of her book, A Certain Justice, where she actually had inscribed to Pastor Mentzer, God blessings on your ministry, signed P.D. James, that a friend of mine had purchased for me when she was studying in Cambridge. I learned about the work of P.D. James from my theological mentor and seminary professor, Walter Bowman, who used it in one of her books in one of his classes. Walter Bowman was the person that whenever he read a murder mystery, he always read the first or the last chapter first. He said the reason that he did that is because he wanted to know who was going to be around at the end so that he didn't make any time investing in those characters that wouldn't be around at the end of the story. As I read through P.D. James's works, I hold on to a number of moments in those books where what she wrote really captured my imagination. And one of those moments is with the main character, a superintendent for the Scotland Yard named Adam Dalgleish. And we get a picture of his own personal life in one of the books, and we hear about how at a young age his wife and child were killed. And what he recalls is that after they had died, the shock of every time he went home at the end of the day, everything was where he left it, in his house. Because there was no one there anymore to move things or to mess things up. And the emptiness that created in him because things didn't move. It really reminds us that to have a relationship with another person is a messy endeavor. It's not easy, it's not simple, but it's complex to try to have a relationship with another human being. And I think we can see a larger scale expression of that as we see what is happening in our own nation this week as races and people try to figure out how to coexist in our nation, that it is messy and it is complex. When Mark writes this gospel, Mark borrows heavily from both Deuteronomy 30 and also Isaiah 60, phrases of which are captured in the text that I just read. And what Mark does in borrowing from Deuteronomy and Isaiah is speaking of this notion of the gathering of Israel from all the nations of the world that God will accomplish at the end of time. That there will come a moment that from all over the world, God will gather God's people together. It's further captured in Micah, the fourth chapter, beginning with the first verse, where we hear that at that time, at the end of time, that all will flow together from all of the nations and God will gather them together. It lifts up this theme that there will become a moment when there will be ultimate fellowship of God and God's people. Mark captures that essence of that ultimate fellowship of God and God's people. And it's a theme that as God's people experience certain moments in their lives, spoke to them at the moment. And for Mark, the question becomes, how is that theme being expressed now as they live in this current time? In a time when they see war, they see people who are hungry, when there's hardship. It's the calling to not believe that God is causing the suffering, but that God's hand is present in the suffering, drawing people to God's self in that final reunion. I want to note that that sense of ultimate fellowship does not come with a sense of judgment and condemnation for those who are outside, which is the natural human response. Because what we want out of God is a God who will welcome us and affirm us and tell us that we are right, but we also want a God who will take those people with whom we disagree and with whom we have great hatred and to see that God will bring about their destruction. This is simply about that ultimate fulfillment of reunion of God's people. It's the overwhelming framework for how God's people are to view the world and what is happening in the world. That you must see it from this very broad and theological framework. Now, what we discover is that put out in front of God's people will be other ways of viewing the world. Disciplines and concepts and ways of thinking that people will bring to understand the world that aren't necessarily this broad view of what God intends for creation. And in the book Theology Without Metaphysics, what we find out is every single one of those concepts, every single one of those ways of understanding the world that aren't rooted in God's vision for the world will in the end bring violence to both creation, people, and ideas. And so, for example, the way that narrowly defining how we make decisions can impact creation. Look at the decision to drill for natural gas. When it's defined solely as an economic concern and how it can bring prosperity, we lose how creation is violated, the integrity of creation is violated by that very act, and we don't ask the broader implications of those decisions. When we define what makes a good person if we narrowly define that person in a certain way, we violate that person. And we must be truthful, and we must be honest, that most of us define what it means to be a good person by saying the person should be white. That's the framework through which we view the world. This past week, I'm aware of two of the elementary children in our congregation who are of another race, who have said to their parents, in watching what has happened in Ferguson and across our country, who have said, "I wish I was white." Please don't define yourself by comparing yourself that way. When we narrowly define what makes a good person in that way, we violate people of other races. And when we narrowly define justice by whether a certain protocol was followed, we find out that it violates those who are impacted by that protocol. After the decision from Ferguson was announced the next day, I either texted or emailed every member of the congregation who was a police officer and said, "My thoughts and prayers are with you today because I know it's going to be harder to be a police officer today than it was yesterday." I also was very much aware that it would be much harder to be a black youth walking the streets than it was the day before as well. And when all involved walk out of that moment when a decision was justified as justice and it makes it harder to be a complete human being, I think that definition of justice is too narrowly defined and violates humanity. It is the call to redefine our world in what God intends for it. So now the natural response right now is, "Yeah, but." Then you're running through in your head all the ways you can counter what I just said, because at the base level, it will make you uncomfortable. But as we read in Mark 3, Jesus took time to heal a man with a crippled hand on the Sabbath. And the good religious people of the day said to Jesus, "You're breaking the rules because you're healing on the Sabbath." That following rules, especially the ones that we hold fast to, is more important than honoring the integrity of another human being. God's people in this time of watching and waiting, of wakefulness, are going to be a people that are confronted with false teachers. That is, there are going to be people who are going to put out in front of us ways to help make things easier for us to live. Many different ways of thought, many theologies, many different kinds of teaching. And I want you to know, if it immediately makes you feel good, it probably isn't helpful to you. And so God's people are called to challenge these false teachers, to call one another back to defining the world the way God defines the world. And you must understand that in doing so, those false teachers and the people who follow them will be hard on those who dare to speak the truth. In Jesus' day, we saw the persecution of those who dared to challenge the false prophets. Now, we will immediately, in this modern day, have a problem in approaching this concept of persecution because most of us live with a persecution complex. We already assume that we are the one who is persecuted for who we are and what we believe. I think this persecution complex is expressed in so many ways. One is in the sense that if I feel uncomfortable about something, that means that someone else has done something wrong. It's immediate. If I'm uncomfortable, it must be your fault. Instead of me dealing with the discomfort, it happens in ministries, in congregations. When there's something new, when there is a change, I'm uncomfortable with it. It must be someone else's fault for making me uncomfortable. But maybe you need to learn with the discomfort of the change. Furthermore, in this persecution complex way of world, we find people no longer define what's going on in moral terms. They don't even define what's going on by naming their emotions, but they define things medically. That is, there is a need for a diagnosis. Because once we have a diagnosis, we can prove that the problem is outside of myself, outside of my control, and someone else can solve the problem for me. It's once again putting outside of oneself the root of the issue. With persecution complexes, what we have are people, whenever they perceive that they are being attacked, whenever they are uncomfortable, gather around with those who will agree with them. It's a pack mentality, sort of a wolf pack mentality, that we surround ourselves who will agree with us. And what we do then is, as we surround ourselves with people who agree with us, is we use our intellect, we use our way of thinking to justify where everyone else is wrong. And we control that population by either punishing anyone who dares to question the pack, or we kick the person out of the pack if they dare not confirm, dare not live up to the way we want them to live. It's that pack mentality. And we use each other to self-justify ourselves. That is such an easy way to fall into the trap of snap judgments. It fascinates me. As I was reading Lancaster Online, as they posted the story of the protest that happened downtown Lancaster on Friday morning, the number of people who said the people who were protesting should get a job and stop protesting. They said, maybe if you tell them you'll take away their welfare, they won't protest. The assumption is that the people who are protesting are uneducated and unemployed. It's a way to diminish the people and not hear the truth for what they are saying. The snap judgments leads us to diminish those who disagree with us. In the persecution complex, we also must understand the impact of being those who are in power. And we cannot deny that those who are white have power. It is easier to be a white person in our country than another race. Another powerful image from P.D. James was developed as she took time to reflect upon a character who had witnessed a murder. And this character was in her bedroom at night trying to go to sleep. And we hear that on the bedstand next to her was a picture of her father and her mother and her brother and her. And as she's laying there trying to get to sleep and looking at the picture, she was remembering how abusive her father was. And she said it was one of those things where her and her brother tried just to stay invisible so that their father wouldn't abuse them. And she remembers reflecting upon the fact that you would think you would be worried about your brother when your father was beating on him, but she remembers feeling relieved because that means her father wasn't beating her instead. In the end of this self-conversation, James makes this assessment of this woman. But her abusive father had done his job well. She didn't hate him. She hated herself. We must take into account the harm that has been done to those who are not in positions of power in our nation. And the rage and the hatred that comes out of that, that too often, because it's impossible to deal with, is directed upon self. Any more yeah buts out there yet? Mark in the 7th chapter tells us of the good religious people confronting Jesus because his disciples were eating with defiled hands. They weren't following the rules and cleansing their hands before they ate. And in the confrontation, Jesus in essence says, "You have a clever way of rejecting God's law to uphold your own teachings." We must be confronted with the reality of how we replace the vision that God has for this world with our own ways of defining the world that violate creation and people and concepts. Richard Hayes, in his book, The Moral Vision of the New Testament, says that in the Gospel of Mark, the appearance of Jesus ruptures the status quo. That the illusions of stability and authority are stripped away from all people in power. That God's abrupt intervention fractures historical continuities and human life is laid bare before God. Our lives open and laid bare before God. So that in the coming of Jesus, God has mounted a decisive campaign against the powers of evil that oppress humanity, done in a way that culminates in the cross of Jesus Christ. So what comes out of that then is that God reverses the positions of insiders and outsiders, Hayes says. And what you see is the disciples, those closest to Jesus, never quite get it. And the outsiders, the people who are struggling, are open to what Jesus has to offer because their need is great. It redefines power and the nature of suffering and uses power not to be served but to serve one another, shown forth not in winning but in death on the cross. That strengthens those who suffer and challenges those who are in power, asking them to surrender to the power of the cross. We are so remarkably good at telling people how they are wrong. I think that we must consider that as people who are watching and waiting for the coming of Jesus and God setting it right, that that time is filled with good news. Speaking to that which is good, naming that which is good. And the church cannot fall asleep and remain silent in naming what is good. It is important as we name what is good to say that it is good for white men to acknowledge the position of privilege and power they have in the world. I went to lunch with a Spanish-speaking colleague of mine, and we went to a restaurant up around the corner, and he said to me, "I wouldn't normally go to a restaurant like this by myself, but I'm always comfortable going when I'm with a white man because I know they will accept me in the restaurant." Must acknowledge the privilege we have as white males. We must learn to let people be humanized. Years ago, when we had a citywide gathering after the suicide death of three prisoners at the county jail, the last group of people to speak were the family members of those who had committed suicide. And what I discovered in listening to each one of them speak was they wanted the rest of us to hear that their loved one was a human being, not simply known for the crime they had committed. We must humanize Michael Brown and Darren Wilson. Time for the white community to stop talking and start listening. One of the greatest mistakes of this week is Officer Wilson going on television and talking about what happened. It reeks of self-justification and is not helpful in any way. But being willing to listen means that we are willing to hear the hate and the rage that is coming out of the hearts of those of other races. To listen to the hate and the rage because it is there because of what has happened to them. Stop talking and start listening. People of God, waiting for that moment when God brings together all of humanity and sets it right. We will see this world then as a world that God is transforming. And even in this moment, might just start to get glimpses of that work in action.